This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're reporting next on the side effects of our mass media. Every year we get a little bit closer to a world where you get what you want when you want it, at least when it comes to entertainment. New technologies have given us access to countless channels for music and television and film. But NPR's Laura Seidel wonders whether convenience is costing us a sense of common culture.
Remember the Seinfeld episode when a reporter mistakenly thought that Jerry and George were lovers?
We knew you were eavesdropping. That's why my friend said all that. It was on purpose. We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
And not that there's anything wrong with it if you didn't see the episode or any of the other famous ones, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Even if you didn't see them, you knew about them.
That's Clifford Nass, Stanford University communications professor. He says Seinfeld, a show about nothing, actually meant something. Americans laughed together.
That's really what marks cultural touchstones, things that people are aware of, that they can share, that they can make reference to, that they don't actually have to consume themselves.
More than 40% of American households saw the final episode of Seinfeld in the spring of 1998, according to the Nielsen Company. Fast forward about 11 years.
The winner of American Idol 2009 is Chris Allen!
You can be forgiven if you have no idea who Chris Allen is. American Idol may be the most popular program on television today, but only about 16% of American households saw this year's finale. Over the last decade, the number of television channels has more than doubled. There's Lifetime for women, Spike for men, the Sci-Fi Channel, and onto that, the internet and YouTube. Professor Abigail Dukosnik with UC Berkeley's Center for New Media says once the nation shared trusted anchors like Walter Cronkite and Peter Jennings, now everyone can find the news that suits their taste.
Fox News will take a stance that represents a certain set of values, and The Daily Show will take a stance that has a very different ideology than Fox News. For better or for worse, when we did have 60 million people watching any one network's nightly news program, that meant that 60 million people had to all receive the same information and make up their minds about it and be in dialogue with one another about it.
Dukosnik says people watch the news they find agreeable, and then they use the internet to chat with the people who share their tastes and opinions. Stanford professor Clifford Nass says social scientists find the current trends worrisome.
There have never been cultures or societies in which there weren't a very large set of shared ideas, norms, values, stories, cultures, etc. We've just never seen that before.
Of course, having a mainstream culture also meant that some people felt left out.
I'm Kenna Fung, and I'm kind of a nerd.
A science fiction nerd. Fung particularly loves the BBC program Doctor Who, which airs on cable in the U.S. Doctor Who is an alien who travels through time and space. He often visits Earth.
I'm the Doctor, by the way.
Astrid, sir. Astrid Peth.
Nice to meet you, Astrid.
Merry Christmas.
Doctor Who didn't interest anyone else in school, says Fung.
Even though I know they had a lot of viewers across the world and across the country, nobody at school was really into it, and so I felt like I was the only one who liked that, and I had nobody to talk about it with.
At least not in person. But she did meet people through online fan sites.
How have you been?
I've been fine, thanks.
Fung met Mary Bister online. The two of them have never met in person. I suggested Fung give her a ring, and they had no problem launching into a conversation about the new actor who will play Doctor Who.
I can't wait to see if Matt Smith has any weird facial expressions just like David Tennant did.
Well, don't you think he has to with that face?
In the real world, this friendship between 35-year-old Bister, a medical student at the University of Chicago, and 19-year-old Fung, a community college student in San Mateo, would be unlikely.
I don't have a whole lot of young adults, late teens, early 20s friends, but in the Doctor Who fandom, that's a big percentage of who's there.
Clearly, these kinds of connections cross bridges between people in ways that watching Seinfeld or the evening news at home never could. But Stanford professor Clifford Nass says they're not likely to hold a nation together.
The things that tend to glue society together are people who share a number of things together. It makes it easier to mobilize, to bring people together behind a cause, behind an issue.
Like healthcare or war. There were decades when if you hadn't heard of certain cultural touchstones like Seinfeld or Michael Jackson, you might be considered to be living under a rock. But as technology lets each of us indulge our personal desires and tastes, we now can crawl under our own rocks. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. Spike Jonze was a band leader who made funny music on records and radio in the 1940s and on television in the 1950s. The humor was broad, and the target of the joke was typically a song. For example, that sultry tune about a quiet romantic encounter, Cocktails for Two.
In some secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue, with someone sharing a delight, chat, this and that, and cocktails for two.
Cocktails for Two was a hit for Spike Jonze and his City Slickers, apparently much to the chagrin of the composer. In addition to a legacy of subverted songs, Spike Jonze left a widow, singer Helen Greco, and four children. His son Spike Jr. has released a collection of his father's TV shows on DVD, and mother and son came to our California studio to talk about it. Spike Jr. told how his father, a drummer with an uncanny gift for the cowbells, came to expand his band's arrangements with seemingly extraneous sounds.
He went to see Stravinsky conduct the Firebird Suite, and Stravinsky apparently had a brand new pair of patent leather shoes. And every time he rose to give a downbeat, you'd hear this.
I see.
And on the way home, my dad was thinking, what happens if you took sound effects and replaced musical notes with them? Wouldn't it sound fun? So he got some of the band members together that he was really close with. They put a group together. They did some records. They took them to Decca, and Decca said, gee, this is fabulous. We think RCA should have it. And then he
But you're saying that Spike Jonze was inspired by the sound of Igor Stravinsky's shoes.
That's correct.
I'd like to hear from both of you your thoughts on how you describe the kind of humor of Spike Jonze and the City Slickers, which it wasn't, there was no social commentary in it. It wasn't satire. Helen, how do you describe the humor of Spike Jonze?
Well, it was just amazing. He was a one of a kind. He was an absolute genius, I think, in musical satire.
Spike Jr., how do you describe your father's history?
Well, I think there was an element of satire because if you think about the period of time that Dad really skyrocketed, the big bands were very staid, and all of a sudden Spike Jonze comes along with check suits, shooting off guns, chewing gum. And then, politics-wise, you don't get much better than Der Fuhrer's face.
When Der Fuhrer says, wie ist der Master Race? Wie heil, heil, right in Der Fuhrer's face. Not to love Der Fuhrer is a great disgrace. So wie heil, heil, right in Der Fuhrer's face.
Der Fuhrer's face, we should say, was Spike Jonze's wartime contribution, or at least the most famous example of it.
Correct.
One reaction I had in watching these programs after all these years on your DVDs was, this is stuff I'd be more accustomed to seeing on the BBC at one time than in the U.S.
It's funny that you should say that, because Spike's biggest audience was the English audience, London. They really are satirically minded in England. And I think Spike had a great deal to do with that. He takes the William Tell Overture and does a whole number on that. That is just an amazing how he could take that number and do what he did with that.
When Spike Jonze would play what for lack of a better term I'll call a percussion instrument, some thing to which lots of bits of metal are stuck, and he would hit it with drumsticks. First of all, was there a standard instrument that he had created for doing that? Did he know where the different notes were on it? How did he play this thing?
Well, he was basically a studio drummer. His basic instrument as a musician was drums. Mm-hmm. And everything
and xylophone, I think.
And xylophone, and everything extended So he had his cowbell set built, which was basically an octave and a half of tuned cowbells.
What's he doing there?
He's playing an octave and a half of tuned cowbells, and then with his mallet, he hits a brake drum, and the mallet goes into the air, and then he catches it. Other than that, he's doing nothing.
Other than that. And explain to us the point of Spike Jonze wearing these amazingly loud, isn't loud enough, these fortissimo suits that were checkered patterns.
Everybody else was in black tuxedos with white shirts, and he came along with putting all the band in check suits. His were very special. He had six of them made. I think at the time they were like $1,000 or $1,500 a piece. There were different combinations for different types of music. He would make costume changes throughout his 2.5-hour presentation. His basic one was yellow with purple stripes. And then he had black and white. He had gold and white for more ballads and things like that. And then he even had one with tails that was all leopard. And it was just, it's unfortunate that we don't have color on these items, because this stage looked phenomenal.
In liner notes that the novelist Thomas Pynchon wrote for a collection of Spike Jonze music, I read that Mickey Katz, who played with your father and your late husband, Helena, wrote this in his memoir, that at one time Spike Jonze wanted to have a very serious symphonic jazz orchestra, like Paul Whiteman's orchestra, and that nobody wanted to hear him do that. They wanted him to do fun.
That's right. He called it Spike Jonze's other orchestra, and he was very seriously doing very straight, wonderful music, and the audience just didn't accept it.
Yes, Mickey Katz evidently wrote, people said, if we want a symphony, we'll go to the Hollywood Bowl. We came to hear Spike Jonze, not Stokowski.
Exactly.
Was that a disappointment to him?
Yes, it was, because he was such a fine musician himself and had such a great appreciation for the classics and everything, that he was hoping it would be a turnabout for him, that he'd be able to do both. But he worked the Trocadero in Beverly Hills at the time on Sunset Boulevard on the Strip. Although it was well received that evening, people went away and said, oh, we like the old Spike Jonze.
It's been such fun, but now it's done. We're sorry we must leave. So here's a drink we had for you before we go. Gonna go at the start of the Spike Jonze Show.
Well, Helen Greco and Spike Jonze Jr., thank you both very much for talking with us today.
Robert, thank you.
Our pleasure, Robert. Thanks so much.
Spike Jonze died in 1965. The DVD featuring the television shows is called The Best of Spike Jonze. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now let's go to Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here. Hi, Lee. What's up? Happy New Year.
Hey, Michelle. Happy New Year to you. And now we're going to do a little year in review, Back Talk style. And it has been an extraordinary year in politics and in pop culture. We saw the historic election of Barack Obama as the nation's first black president. And we talked a lot on this program about how his presidency is shaping the national dialogue on race. Well, of course, we took that debate online, and you might remember this comment from Troy.
We should stop calling ourselves African-American. It diminishes us and makes us some kind of subclass of American. We don't call the average white person a European-American. Instead of us calling ourselves African-Americans and having this us-against-them concept, we should just call ourselves Americans.
Okay, well, thank you, Troy, once again, and all those who've weighed in over the course of the year. Lee, carrying us into the spring was the disturbing story of R&B super couple Chris Brown and Rihanna, who became the poster children for domestic violence after Brown battered Rihanna shortly before the Grammy Awards. He ended up pleading guilty to a felony assault charge. We had a number of conversations about how the story of Rihanna and Chris Brown is sadly a common one, and many of you wrote to tell us your stories. Back in April, we heard this from Lisa.
I have a 2-year protective order against my abusive ex-husband. I left after he strangled me and threatened to take our 2-year-old and 11-month-old twins away so that I would never see them again. My denial was lifted, and I ran with my 3 boys. We have been divorced for 7 years now, 2 more physical abuses during this time, the last time a year ago, leaving me with 3 bulging discs in my back and a concussion.
And Michelle, I'm always amazed by the personal stories that people share with us. For instance, earlier this year, we reported on racial disparities in the foster care system, with Black youngsters more likely to be steered into foster care than their white counterparts. After that story, we heard this personal story from Callie.
Having been in foster care most of my life, emotionally, it destroyed me, completely destroyed me. I'm not fully healed yet, but I'm working on it, and I have a wonderful husband and wonderful children who are supporting me and trying to help me get past a lot of the emotional issues that I had.
Well, it is good to hear how love is helping Callie heal. And Lee, we were also delighted and sometimes amused to learn more about our listeners' love lives. Yes, with everything going on in the world, we did manage to squeeze in some romance stories. Not all of them were happy, but hey, we tried. Hey. In September, we talked about how many Black women might be scoring high grades professionally, but batting low in the love department. Our focus came from a Yale University study indicating that Black men are more likely to marry outside their race and Black women outside of their educational achievement levels. We receive lots of feedback on this story, including this note from Pamela. Pamela wrote, "I am 47, have a master's degree, and have been single for 7 years. Have I given up on Black men? Not at all. If that was the case, I'd be giving up on my 4 beautiful sons, who I know will bless some lucky woman. I won't ever discount a brother because his life path didn't include college."
And Michelle, we all remember Laszlo. He talked to us back in October following our report on how success in the online dating world tends to favor white men and women overall. Now, that research came from the online hookup site OkCupid. Now, Laszlo told us how, like Pamela, he's also not throwing in the towel.
I've tried online dating on and off for some time now. In all honesty, I have to say that Black women are the least likely to write me back. Now, for instance, I've been on blackplanet.com a few times, and I figured I'd have better results there. The majority of women who apply back to me and even initiate correspondence have always been white. No, I have not given up on Black women.
Maybe Laszlo and Pamela. Well, never mind. We'll work on that later.
Well, the Tell Me More matchmakers, that's a good way to bring in the new year, right?
I like it. Remember, with Tell Me More, the love connection never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website. Go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, Jane Lynch started to get the recognition she deserves in her role on the Fox TV series Glee as the coach of the cheerleading squad. As part of our holiday week series of memorable interviews from 2009, we're going to hear an excerpt of the interview we recorded in November. Before Glee, Jane Lynch was best known for her performances in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, the mockumentary Best in Show, The L Word, and the Starz TV series Party Down. In last summer's film Julie and Julia, she played Julia Child's sister. In case you missed the first year of Glee, it's about a high school teacher trying to put together a winning Glee club with a group of students who are mostly losers. The Glee club coach tries to be sensitive to the needs and insecurities of his students, but the cheerleading coach, played by Jane Lynch, is mean to her girls and never satisfied with their performance. She sees the Glee club as her rival and at one point tries to take it over. Here she is confronting the Glee club coach, played by Matthew Morrison.
So I had a little chat with Principal Figgins, and he said that if your group doesn't place at regionals, he's cutting the program. Ouch.
You know, you don't have to worry about Glee Club. We're going to be fine.
Really? Because I was at the local library where I read Cheerleading Today aloud to blind geriatrics. I came across this little page turner, show choir rule book. And turns out you need 12 kids to qualify for regionals. Last time I looked at you, only had 5.5. Here, cripple in the wheelchair. I also took the liberty of highlighting some special ed classes for you. Maybe you could find some recruits. Because I'm not sure there's anybody else who's going to want to swim over to your island of misfit toys.
Are you threatening me, Sue?
Threatening you? Oh, no. presenting you with an opportunity to compromise yourself?
You betcha.
Jane Lynch, welcome to Fresh Air. I want you to describe your character in Glee.
Well, she's kind of that inner mean girl that a lot of us have, that she's kind of right out in front. She doesn't have a filter. She doesn't have that socially acceptable way that we, you know, put how we might really feel. We'll put them into terms that, you know, are softer than what Sue would do. She's kind of right out there, and she takes great delight in her heinousness and her political incorrectness. And so that's where she gets her glee from.
Now, you've almost developed a catchphrase. You think that's hard, try, fill in the blank. What have been your favorite you think that's hard retorts?
My favorite one was, you think this is hard, try launching a fall show in May. That's hard. We did that for a promo. But the first one I came up with was the waterboarding one. If you think this is hard, try being waterboarded. That's hard. And then Ian Brennan, our writer, came up with a ton more. And I think in the pilot I say, you think this is hard, I'm living with hepatitis. That's hard.
So you came up with the waterboarding one?
I did.
How did you come up with that one? What was the context?
Well, the cheerleaders are in this pyramid, and their muscles are shaking, and I'm making them hold it, and I'm standing there with a stopwatch, and on my way to work that day I was thinking, how can I mock them and shame them while they're in that horrible, stressful position? And I started thinking about stress positions, which is what they do, you know, that's part of torture. And then I thought, waterboarding is much harder than this.
Now, you got what I think was your big break in movies in the mockumentary Best in Show about people who bring their purebred dogs to compete in a dog show. And you play a trainer who's working with a standard poodle. And the owner's trophy wife, his over-the-hill trophy wife who's had, like, a lot of cosmetic surgery has become your significant other.
Right.
And so here's a scene from Best in Show in which you're basically talking to the camera with the trophy wife who has become very close to you.
With Sherry Ann, we have this fantastic friendship, too. It's really great. And we have a little bit of a family dynamic going here, and it pretty much mirrors what I grew up with, you know. My father was the taskmaster, the disciplinarian, which is what I do. I'm the mommy slash daddy. That's right.
Like Mr. Punishment.
Oh, well, you know, and also reward. Mm. But Sherry's responsible for the unconditional love, you know.
And the decorative abilities.
Exactly, the heart and the soul, you know, which is what my mother did, and that was her job. You know, she was there for the unconditional love. And it worked for my family, you know, until my mom committed suicide in 81.
That's my guest, Jane Lynch, in a scene from Best in Show. Was that improvised?
Yes. I remember I was riding in the van on the way to the location, and I thought of that, about the suicide thing, yes.
Now, Best in Show was directed by Christopher Guest. How did you meet him?
I was doing a commercial for Kellogg's Frosted Flakes, and he directed it. I did a lot of commercials the 90s in Los Angeles, and I got lucky enough to get into one of his, and he directs commercials all the time. He loves doing that. And we did it a la Guffman, Waiting for Guffman. It was improvised and everything. And then about 3 months later, I ran into him at a restaurant, and he was in the process of casting Best in Show. And, he said, hey, come to my office today. And, you know, by the end of the day, I was, you know, had plans to go to Vancouver to shoot this. And I was thrilled because when I saw Waiting for Guffman, I about fell out of my seat and, and down on my knees, please, please let me work this way. This is how I want to work. This is the way to do it. And this guy's got it down. So it was really a dream come true, a ridiculous, preposterous dream come true.
So what was the Frosted Flakes commercial like?
We were stalking Tony the Tiger. Myself and my husband were standing out in Battle Creek, Michigan. Of course, we shot in Los Angeles, but it was in Battle Creek, Michigan, waiting for Tony to go by. It wasn't a very successful campaign, but but it was fun to do.
And what other commercials did you do?
I'm best known, Terry, for my work in the Nexium commercial, where I'm standing on a cliff saying, I am every woman who's ever suffered from acid reflux. And I stopped it before it destroyed the lining of my esophagus.
So that's I'm best known for that.
I always wonder if you worry if you do a commercial like that, the people will see you and think, acid reflux. What a tragedy, you know.
And then associate my face with it. You know, exactly. I'm so happy to have the job and to be able to pay my rent that month. You know, it's you know, people say, why did you do that stint on Married with Children? I was like, I jumped up and down when I got that job. That paid my rent.
Now, since you played a lesbian in Best in Show, did people, and that since that was the movie that people really noticed you in terms of movies?
Yeah.
So did people assume that you were a lesbian because you played one?
No, not at all. No, I don't, you know, I don't think so. I don't think that happens so much. I think you can play a character and people don't confuse you that perhaps you're that way in real life. I mean, nobody asked Jennifer Coolidge if she was one either, I don't think.
But in this case, you are.
But in this case, I am. Yeah.
So was it a kind of inadvertent coming out for you? Were you already out in the industry?
Well, I wasn't really known in the industry before Best in Show, and I didn't think twice about portraying a lesbian. Again, I jumped up and down when I got that job. You know what? I didn't think too much about that at all. I never hid who I was. I also didn't lead with it. I don't feel like the need to walk into a room and say, you know, as a gay person, I need to have this, this, and this. And nobody really seemed to care. And if I lost work or if I lost opportunities because I was gay, it happened behind my back and I didn't know about it. I've had it really easy. You know, it's been just very accepted, and nobody seems to care.
You said that you had your first gay relationship when you were 20, but it took 11 or 12 years to actually come out to your family.
Right.
Were you out to yourself before you turned 20?
Yes. Yeah, it was reluctant. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to deal with. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to be. I'm one of those people who like to toe the line. I don't, as much as I, you know, love being an actress, I don't like calling attention to myself in that way. I don't want to be different. I'm not a rebel. I just want to be like everybody else. So it was a you know, kind of a reluctant realization and a, oh, God, really? You know? So, yeah, and it took me, you know, I think if I came out to my parents when I was 18, it would have been a different story. It might have been harder. But when I was 31 and finally came out, via a letter I wrote them, it was great. It was wonderful because we were starting to be estranged to each other because they didn't know about a very fundamental part of who I was. And so it was a good thing. And there was no drama around it. It was really kind of a lovely moment where we all came together and said, you know, oh, of course this doesn't mean anything, you know, and we still love you. And it was, you know, it was actually a wonderful, wonderful moment.
Was it helpful to you when Ellen DeGeneres came out on her show?
Yes. Yeah. I think it was helpful for all of us. And I think that's one of the reasons that I walked such an easy path. She, you know, blazed it for us. And I know she was kind of reluctant to do that, too. I think it was a big deal when she came out. And it really kind of, you know, it rocked the world. And, I mean, look where she is now. She's got this great show and all these Midwestern ladies are there dancing with her. I think it's a great thing that she did.
So at what phase of your career were you in when Ellen came out?
I was doing voiceovers and commercials. You know, I was just a work-a-day actor making a nice living and, you know, nobody knew my name type of place. You know, I hadn't done Best in Show yet.
Voiceovers. What were you doing?
I did a lot of commercial voiceovers. I did, you know, for like Safeway. I did announcer copy, and then I would do stuff for radio. You know, with a partner reads, as we call them. I made my living in voiceover for about 5 or 6 years, and I would do the occasional on-camera commercial or the occasional guest spot on a sitcom. But mostly, I was, you know, making my living as a voiceover person. I loved it. It's a great gig. It's a great job.
So what kind of characters were you supposed to represent?
I kind of have a stock old lady voice. I have kind of a stock Midwestern mom voice.
Can you give us a taste of them?
Yeah. Make sure you put some tomatoes on the sandwich. That's kind of a salsa. And then I always did this with my voice, kind of like a... kind of an old lady kind of thing. And I use it even – I repeat it even in you know, when I do guest spots on sitcoms. I have like two tricks, Terry, and I just roll them out.
Well, Jane Lynch, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
I wish you continued success.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jane Lynch recorded in November. She co-stars in the Fox TV series Glee as the mean-spirited coach of the cheerleading squad.